This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome to a brand spanking new fresh out of the sealed box episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. My name's Dan. We're here as always, really, to discover the most amazing, dangerous, wonderful and often just kind of plain weird things that are out there in the universe. Today, you can find out how much sand there actually is in the entire world. We'll learn about the Earth's most deadly snake. We'll talk to a man also whose job it is to examine eruptions. What a way to earn your money. First, we're travelling back in time to the age of the dinosaurs, though, and we're looking at the skies.
Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
At the Natural History Museum.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. Welcome to the end of the Jurassic period, 145 million years ago. As the Jurassic period came to a close and the Cretaceous period began, many new types of animal and plant life were evolving, and a new kind of creature was starting to take to the skies. Birds.
Watch out, something is swooping at us.
Wow, it's an Archaeopteryx, the first known bird. Only 10 fossils of the Archaeopteryx have been found, but they're important because they prove that birds evolved from dinosaurs. However, they were very different to birds we know today. The Archaeopteryx was the size of a crow. Whilst they had feathers, they also had teeth, claws on their wings, and long tails. They also weren't great flyers, more likely to glide for short distances rather than flap about.
He hasn't seen us. He's perched up in the tree.
Being able to hide in trees is a great way to stay safe. It's believed that small dinosaurs evolved into bird-like creatures either to help them escape from predators, more powerful dinosaurs who preyed on smaller and lighter creatures, or to help them go after prey that lived up in trees, such as insects and small lizards. To survive over thousands of years, these small dinosaurs evolved. They grew long but light feathers, and their front legs got longer to form wings that would help them fly. Other dinosaurs grew feathers, but as they stayed too large, and as their arms weren't strong enough, they never flew. One such dinosaur was the Dilong, which was the same size as a dog. Although he couldn't fly, his feathers would have helped him keep warm and might have allowed him to show off to other Dilongs when competing over territory or mates.
Quick! That's not a bird. It's a flying reptile. Let's get out of here.
I think we're safe here. Along with the early birds, pterosaurs ruled the sky. Pterosaurs didn't have feathers. They were flying reptiles with strong arm muscles and wings made of thin skin. But don't worry, that's a Ramphorhynchus. He's mostly interested in sea life. He flies low over the lagoons and uses his pointed beak to grab at fish and other small creatures.
Paleontology. Pick.
When all that's left behind are fossils, it's hard to say what colour dinosaur skin or Archaeopteryx feathers were. Recently, scientists have discovered small parts of pigment cells called melanosomes. Through the use of clever technology and comparing results to today's animals and birds, they can make some amazing discoveries. For example, they now know that the Cynoceropteryx, a small bird-like dinosaur, had dark-coloured stripes along its tail and an orange-coloured crest along its back. Travel back in time to the age of the dinosaur.
The new interactive exhibition at the Natural History Museum. Walk alongside life-size moving animatronic dinosaurs and other strange creatures among the smells and sounds of the prehistoric Jurassic swamps and Cretaceous deserts. Find out more at nhm.ac.uk.
But watch out for what's around the corner.
You can can hear all of the episodes in our brilliant Age of the Dinosaurs series for free on iTunes, on the Fun Kids app, and over at funkidslive.com. So in a sec, we will learn what volcanoes actually are and why they feel it's so necessary to hurl flaming hot rock and molten lava from their head into the sky and often at people from time to time. First, I want to say hello to Riseback, to Burn, to Anna as well, who have left us a review to say that they're listening to the show. Hopefully, fingers crossed, you're loving it as well. Remember, if you want a shout-out and a hello on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, by the way, it's dead easy. Just get out your phone or your tablet, find us on iTunes, on the podcast store, subscribe if you haven't already. You can become part of that squad. Then drop us a review, let us know what you think, leave your name. So simple. Next week, I might say hello to you.
This is Fun Kids.
We're talking explosions on the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and on the phone is Dr. Pete Rowley. He is a volcanologist at the University of Portsmouth. I guess the first question has to be the most simple one. Why do volcanoes erupt?
Ooh, good question. It's all to do with pressure. The magma that supplies these volcanoes is coming up from very deep down in the Earth's crust, so down to 30 or 40 kilometers below the surface. And as it comes up, it melts some of the rocks around it that it interacts with, and gas starts forming bubbles and increasing the pressure in the chamber. And eventually that pressure is high enough that, a bit like popping the cork off a bottle or opening a can of pop, the magma can break its way up through to the surface. And the amount of gas in that magma will control how explosive that eruption is when it comes up.
Now, all the things that are in the world never cease to blow my brains. You know, amazingly, incredibly beautiful animals. You've got stuff going on under the sea. Why are volcanoes part of that? Why do they exist?
So volcanoes are a way for the Earth to let out heat and let out excess pressure, essentially. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, and throughout that time, it's been going through a process of forming itself into layers. We know the very light stuff has made itself mostly out to the top now. We have an atmosphere. Just below that are slightly less dense materials. They make up the crust. And below that, the further down we go, the denser and denser it gets. And as part of that process, lots of material gets recycled around. And volcanoes are part of that entire plate tectonics process of moving material from the inside to the outside.
And why are some bigger than others? Because a few weeks ago on the podcast, we were talking about the world's largest active volcano, which is Mauna Loa. It's like half a Hawaiian island. Why are some huge and others not so big?
It's a really good question. It's all to do with what process is driving each volcano. So there's several different ways that a volcano can receive that magma to it. You can have hotspot volcanoes, a bit like you see in Hawaii, that feed Mauna Loa. And that is material that's coming up possibly from as deep down as the outside of the Earth's core. So it's potentially traveling maybe 2,000 kilometers up to us. And that material, those hotspot volcanoes, tend to provide fairly continuous but low volume eruptions. That said, if those hotspots, when they first form, or if they we're not entirely sure what process exactly triggers all of these to happen, but certainly we've seen in the geological record, these things can produce truly enormous eruptions. So you talk about Mauna Loa being the biggest volcano on the planet, and certainly it's the tallest, but actually if you look back into the geological record for the size of some of these eruptions, Mauna Loa, well, Kilauea is the little volcano vent on the side of Mauna Loa that produces most of the eruptions at the moment. That produces far, far less than a cubic kilometer of lava every few years. It's a relatively small eruption. If you look at something like, well, Yellowstone is the classic supervolcano, which can produce up to 2,000 cubic kilometers in an eruption. But if you go right back in the geological record, there's eruptions that maybe have produced as much as 6,000 or 7,000 cubic kilometers of material. It's really difficult to get your head around how much that is. So for comparison, that's like burying the entire of the United Kingdom in about 40 meters worth of material. 40 meters is about the length of a blue whale. whale. So cover the UK in blue whales doing handstands, I guess, is the best way to imagine that, if such a thing can be imagined. So no, it's, yeah, the size of volcano is purely driven by how much material is available, and there's lots of different ways of providing that material.
Talk to me about magma then. Why do we never use the words magma and lava unless we're talking about volcanoes? Why do they not make any other appearance in science to us?
Well, I guess for lava, the reason is purely because of definition. Lava is, by definition, magma that has reached the surface. And when a magma reaches the surface, that's what we call a volcano. So you will always talk about lava being associated with volcanoes. You can't not have lava without volcanoes. Magma is any kind of molten rock below the surface. And we only really see it in the crust. And if you want to go on and study geology, which I'd highly recommend because it's the best science, you get magma intruding into the crust in lots of different ways and forming all sorts of really cool structures. In a day-to-day case, it's not something that generally impacts us too much. In terms of it reaching the surface, then it has to be called lava. I guess the only other situation in which magma becomes involved is in some places like Iceland, where they use magma to generate geothermal energy. So they drive hot water down towards the very hot magma, and magma can be anything between maybe 600 degrees up to as much as 1200 degrees Celsius, and they put hot water near it. They use the magma to heat the water, turn it into steam, and then they use that steam to drive turbines back on the surface and generate electricity. So Iceland generates a huge proportion of its electricity using magma, basically.
And if there's all these volcanoes dotted around the world in hot spots, some are extremely volatile, why do they go extinct?
It's all to do, again, with how this magma is being produced and where it's going. So we have these processes that generate magma down at depth, and that magma has to make its way up through the crust. Now, the thing is, as we know from plate tectonics, the crust is always moving. So again, actually, the Hawaiian Islands are a really beautiful example of this. There is a hot spot producing magma, which is rising up through the crust, and it's feeding that volcanic island on top. Now, the thing is, that plume is staying in one place while the oceanic crust above it is moving. And that oceanic crust, as it moves, and it's only moving at, you know, a few millimeters per year, perhaps, maybe up to a few centimeters per year in some places, that moves gradually over geological timescales the volcano away from its heat source. And once that magma can no longer reach the volcano, it's going to end up punching up through the surface and forming a new volcano. So right now, in the middle of the Pacific, slightly further south from Big Island, there is a new volcanic island growing. The supply underneath Big Island, which is where Mauna Loa is gradually dying off as it moves away from the hotspot. And if you look up a map or something like Google Earth, you can go and look at these Hawaiian islands, and what you see is they trail off towards the north, and as they trail off, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And that is the old active volcanoes that, as they've gone extinct, have been gradually then eroded by the ocean waves.
So the new islands are just magma kind of building on magma on magma on magma, and then we just get bigger and bigger.
Exactly, yeah. As you have more lava flows come down, you build a bigger island, and then once it runs out of the magma supply, the islands just start eroding back down again.
Now, Pete, how long have you had the coolest job title ever and been a volcanologist?
Just over 10 years now.
So what's the most amazing and unexpected thing you've learnt in those 10 years about volcanoes that you didn't know before?
Oh, that's a hard one. I'll tell you what, one of the most interesting things to me is that one of the biggest known volcanic eruptions in the Earth's history is in England. The deposits are, it's something called the Millbrigg eruptions, and they happened about 454 million years ago. That's before there was life on the continents. There were trilobites hanging around in the oceans, for those who are into their fossils. Life hadn't come out onto the surface of the continents yet. But those eruptions happened in what is now England. And it was a huge, huge set of eruptions. It was one of the biggest eruptions. Well, it's the oldest big eruption we know of on the planet, or one of the oldest big eruptions we know on the planet. It's really cool stuff. And that happened here.
Dr. Pete, the volcanologist, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thanks for having me on.
This is Fun Kids.
Right, time for this week's Dangerous Dan then, where we look at the most deadly and evil things that are out there in the universe. Once again, we're headed to the place that we visit so often in this feature. I feel like they should give me the key to the country, Australia. Because Australia is home to some of the most deadly species in the world. They've even got the inland taipan, which is the most deadly snake in the world. Some people call the taipan the fierce snake, which I think is a bit stating the obvious, really. It's the most venomous one that exists. It grows to almost 2 metres long. It's got a grey-brown body with black scales on it. It just looks like the dark that you really should be afraid of. Now, right before the taipan strikes its prey, it will curve into an S shape to let you know that it's ready to pounce. Then when it does, it bites with venom that is so toxic it could kill 100 humans, and it can strike 8 times with venom in each bite as well. That's a shockingly high hit rate with so much stamina for a snake. And then if you go 30 minutes without treatment, that's it. That's the end. It's the most toxic of all the species. But there are some less deadly things about the inland taipan. They aren't too common. They're only found in bushes in the deserts in Australia. They only come out when it's cool as well. When they do come out, they aren't too aggressive either. They generally only use their venomous bite to feast on smaller rodents. Still, though, don't be too fooled. If you get too close, the inland taipan will spring, it will bite, and you better get help in 30 minutes. Now, last week, our expert scientist Tom, he told us what Saturn's rings were made out of because of something that you sent in to him on my page over at funkidslive.com. And you can find out if he's answering your question today in just a sec. First, we're catching up with our friends N and G. You see, they're aliens. They're stranded on Earth, they're stuck light years away from home, and they're trying to find the right energy to get them back.
NNG's Energy Challenge. I thought you were packing the stack of power packs in the back.
Hey, I was in charge of the handlebar radar on the sidebar of the space car. You were meant to be stacking the power pack.
Well, if you hadn't been trying to pack 300 cuddly Zoids and your entire collection of Spokatron cards, then maybe you might have realised.
We're going to be stuck on this horrible planet forever. How are we going to get home?
All right, this isn't getting us anywhere. Calm down. There's plenty of energy on planet Earth. You just have to know where to look. Breathe. Breathe.
All right.
Energy is everywhere in the universe, and that means...
there's energy on Earth too.
That's right. There's energy on Earth too. Of course there is. Energy is used for all sorts of things here on Earth, just like it is on planet Zog.
Cooking, keeping warm, powering subparticle laser pods.
Well, the first two, yes, and yes. And they have these things called cars and trains. Not subparticle laser pods, but yes, exactly the same. And hey, it could be worse.
Hungry space dinosaurs?
No, not hungry space dinosaurs. I mean, count yourself lucky we didn't arrive a few hundred years ago. These Earth dudes had to carry their own energy around back then.
You mean they had to pack a stack of power packs in the back too?
No, what I mean is they had to make their own energy when and where they needed it. Normally it looked pretty much like this.
Emergency! Hypervolatile explosive gas!
It's just a bonfire, G. For centuries, humans had to use wood or whatever was to hand to create energy. They would burn it to heat their houses and cook food.
And power their subparticle laser pods?
Quite possibly, if such a thing existed, which is doubtful.
Well, not much use, though, is it? We couldn't carry a load of wood around or carry a bonfire back to the laser pod.
Can't argue with you there. Luckily, humans found some other types of energy along the way. Things called fossil fuels.
Hey, maybe we can use them to get home. Let's check it out.
This is a steam train. It's powered by coal. That's a type of fossil fuel. A couple of hundred years ago, humans figured out that deep underground were fossil fuels, like coal, which could be burned to power steam engines, factories, and trains like this.
Wow! Hidden under the ground. I wonder who hid it there.
No one hid it. It just, well, was created there. Oil is another type of fossil fuel. From this sticky black liquid, humans make petrol for their motor cars. And then there's gas. Now that's a much cleaner and more efficient fuel.
Did you say gas?
Not that kind of gas.
Well, our problems are solved. Fossil fuels sound perfect. Just the one to power the stack of power pods in the back. We'll be home in no time.
Not so fast, mate. Fossil fuels have their drawbacks. Not only are they dirty and create a lot of pollution, they're not that easy to transport. And you have to store them safely. And they need oxygen to burn. And there's not much of that in space. Calm down, G. I haven't finished. Using coal, gas, oil, and other fuels to create electricity is a way to make them much more versatile and useful.
Brilliant!
Watch out! Looks like we're gonna fuse, G!
Here it comes! Whoopee! I love a bit of fusion!
Here it comes! Woohoo!
NNG's Energy Challenge.
You can find out every challenge that NNG have faced for free. Get every episode on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes and at funkidslive.com. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, I've got a question about your questions, right? Is there something about science that you've always wanted to know, but you can't really ask the teacher at school? Maybe you want to figure out why the sky is blue, or why some animals like you and others when you go to the zoo are constantly trying to bite your hand off. Maybe you want to know why snot is green. I don't know. I'm serious, by the way, on that one. I promise there is no question that's too silly or full of nonsense. To find out the answer, right, all you need to do is to let me know. Send it over to my page over at funkidslive.com, because our expert Tom will help answer it. Seriously, he's here every week. Right, Tom, this is from Richard, who is 9, who asks, how much sand is there in the whole world?
Well, sand is little bits of broken up rock. The rock has smashed together and formed tiny particles. It's very small, so there's an awful lot of it in the world. An estimate, and we don't know for sure because nobody can count it all, is 7.5 billion billion pieces. That's 7.5 followed by 17 zeros.
And surely if it's rocks being broken up, it means there's new grains made all the time.
Yes, the number's always increasing, although it's quite imperceptible because there is so much already.
And under the sea, when you're walking along the seabed, is that just covered in sand as well?
Mostly, not all of the seabed, but certainly a large part of it.
So how many zeros did you say?
17.
And was 7? So 7 with 17 zeros, is that right?
7.5 followed by 17.
It's a lot of sand.
It's an awful lot of sand. But it's actually less than the number of stars in the universe.
How many stars are there in the universe?
That's roughly 1 followed by 22 zeros.
And that's always getting outwards as well?
Yeah, there's new stars being formed, but there's also stars dying. So that number is sort of roughly the same.
You're listening to Fun Kids.
We listen to Fun Kids.
Let's see what sciencey stuff then has been happening in the news this week. Emojis are helping computers understand sarcasm better. It's the future, people. Researchers have used 1.2 billion posts on Twitter containing emojis to teach computers sarcasm. They did this by developing a program which learned the tone of the emoji, which helped the computer understand what was said. Also, a process predicted by physicists 40 years ago has come true. Scientists have observed tiny subatomic particles called neutrinos scattering off atoms. They say this has huge implications in physics because these tiny particles, right, they are so small they can travel through the centre of the Earth without hitting anything. And finally, a sad one to end, the first ape to learn sign language has died. Chantek the orangutan lived with a scientist in America for 9 years. He learned sign language to clean his room, to make tools, to even grab fast food. Kind of feel like this scientist was taking advantage of the orangutan. Anyway, the ape has died, aged 39, in a zoo, and the keepers there say that Chantek will be sorely missed. Right, that's it for the news. Time for our own man versus animal challenge, seeing what species are better. Today, it's all about swimming.
Extreme athlete challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the race is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal in our extreme athlete challenge. Today we're at the pool to find out who is the fastest swimmer. In lane one we have Cesar Cielo Filho, winner of the 100 metre freestyle at the 2009 World Championships in Brazil. And in lane two, a sailfish.
This shark-like fish is around 2 metres long with a sail fin to help him cut through the water.
They're taking their places. And they're off. What an amazing start. This pool is 50 metres long and says Arcielo can cover that distance in a little more than 20 seconds.
Meaning his top speed could be as much as 5 or even 6 miles an hour.
But wow, he's been left in the shallow end by the super swimming sailfish.
Not surprising when the sailfish can reach top speeds of 70 miles per hour, over 10 times faster than a human.
As we reach the finish, we can see that it's the sailfish who takes the prize. He's left Cesar standing, and he takes his place as the fastest swimming extreme athlete. Well done to Sailfish.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
There are loads more man versus animal challenges online where we're finding out who is the best species. Should that be what or which? Not too sure. Anyway, free for you to download on the Fun Kids app, on iTunes, and over at funkidslive.com. Oh, just don't mind me. You know, I'm just making spaces on my shelves for all the Nobel Prizes that we will surely get for another groundbreaking edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Because that's it this time around. We've learned about deadly snakes, about explosive eruptions, and heard, kind of, slightly figured out how much sand there might be in all of the beaches all around the world. It's back again next week. And remember, you can actually listen to all of our cool science series on the free Fun Kids app, and you can download them over at iTunes, and you can listen to Fun Kids on DAB digital radio all over the UK on the free Fun Kids app and at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.